Mini episode 805 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the FDH Lounge. This is a very special occasion. You have with you today the two co-creators and original co-executive producers of the FDH Lounge, Rick Morris and Jason Jones, back to look over a decade of doing this show, what we put together, how it came together, our thoughts on the show over the 10 years, the landscape that we've covered, which is the entire world, basically, making this, I'm sure, the most creatively eclectic project I've ever been a part of or ever will be a part of, and I would find it hard to believe the same would not be true of you, Jason. This is something that's really spanned anything and everything, the show where nothing is off topic. That's what we said 10 years ago, and I'll be damned if we haven't lived up to it.
Well, that's the beauty of it. I don't think there's ever been a moment in the history of the lounge where someone brought something to the table and someone else went, nope. Hasn't happened.
Well, that's been the theme, is to basically try to keep everybody on their toes. And it's something that you and I came up with in late 2006, sometime in there. And, of course, this classic open to the show that we've used the last couple of years here, where speaking of two guys together in a cold, rainy parking lot in Cleveland, you and I, after doing the fantasy show, the FantasyDraftHelp.com Insider Show on Thursday nights up at the old Sports Talk Network, you and I just kept brainstorming the one night. We just couldn't get in our cars and leave, and we were talking about this. Like, what if you took this concept and you applied it not just to sports talk, but really the whole world? And what if you tried to break down everything the way we were breaking down fantasy sports? And it was just basically one thing led to another. I remember a couple of car rides where I was coming back from the game of the century, Ohio State, Michigan in 2006, but I was talking to you on the phone a good part of the way that night, and my dad is just kind of rolling his eyes hearing one end of a very grandiose conversation talking about what we want to try and put together. And another car ride where I was recruiting another one of our original dignitaries, Chris Galloway. He and I are coming back from an Ohio University football game that fall. A lot of drives north talking about the lounge in the formative days. Talking to him about that. He's one of the guys I recruited to be part of the original Dignitaries crew. And I spent the better part of a day just downloading like eclectic bumper music, just different things to try to work with the imaging of the show, because I knew that in your hands we were going to put together one hell of a template, which, speaking of which, the most memorable thing out of all of this, I always refer back to this, the legendary Red Robin lunch that we had. First time the crew was all there, the pieces that had been put together, aforementioned Chris Galloway, along with myself, you, Burrell Jackson, Nate Noy, who we've done a lot of stuff with the FantasyDraftHelp.com Insider, and Tim Faust, who I've done a lot of stuff with on Life's a Pitch with Ken Detweiler. And this was just a thing where got them together. Everybody had already committed to it, and everybody thought it was going to be cool, like, in general. But I could tell that, like, the light bulb hadn't gone on for everybody yet on what we were going to be doing. And then you start passing your blueprint around the table. You're the guy that had really gone in with the detailed schematics and showed what a show could look like for 4 hours going from here to there, because we were originally starting as a four-hour show every other Sunday night on Sports Talk Network when the Sunday night submission show, when those guys would be off covering a pay-per-view. We would do the 4 hours in between the pre-show and the post-show. That was the original thought here, is we would be the sandwich meat. So you are passing around this four-hour detailed blueprint, and I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the joy of just looking around that table and seeing a light bulb go on for everybody, and that they were getting it, and that they saw how unique and how different and how special this was going to be.
Yeah, there was well, first of all, there was a lot of conversations, and you alluded to some of that. But there were a lot of conversations that helped shape the idea, because, you know, you tell somebody just at random, we're going to do a show where you know, subject matter can vary. You know, maybe this week it's politics heavy. Maybe next week it's sports heavy. Maybe the week after that it's completely unrelated to both. But then you see the structure, and I agree. I think entering that meeting, everybody thought, oh, this will be cool. It'll be another show. We all can contribute because we all come from a different perspective. I don't think many people had the grasp of it because they hadn't been in those countless conversations. By the time we had that meeting, I'm sure you and I had logged at least a couple days worth of hours kind of hashing it out and finding out the potential of it. And really that's what it came down to, is we weren't limiting ourselves to anything. And I think once people saw that, then that's where you get your light bulb moment.
Yeah, it was really, it was something I'll never forget. Just being there and having it. And I've talked about it with a couple of the guys in the years since, of just kind of reflecting back and seeing that when they saw what you were putting in front of them, and it really started to register in their mind what we were looking at and how far we were going to go with this thing, it was just very, very, very rewarding. So it's a thing where once we started to implement this, again, it felt great, but it was no real surprise to me and you, because it just kind of went the way that the design went. All the thought, all the planning that you and I had put into this thing, subsequently, that ended up going along to great effect. And as I was putting together some compilation material recently, as I was going through some old segments, something that I looked back on was our 100th episode that we did, because you and I did a little bit of a retrospective at that time on the early days of the show. And one of the things that I think really was an early turning point was week two. That was when we had on Bill Raggio, a military blogger from the Long War Journal, and he had just come back from Iraq. So we're talking January 2007. So this is before the surge has really gotten a chance to even get going. I mean, this might have been like the earliest days of the surge and of the effort to try to fight back in Iraq and keep this from just being a complete catastrophe, which it was at that point in time. We had him on for 50 minutes, and we're kind of grilling him, and he's breaking it down for us. And I remember you said on the 100th episode, looking back on it here, that we had already kind of digested that this was going to be a different kind of a show. But I remember you saying on that retrospective show that it was a chance for everybody else to see exactly that we meant business. It wasn't necessarily like a hey, look at us kind of a moment, but I guess that's kind of how it played out in the end.
Oh, yeah. You know, for anyone that had been listening to anything we had done, and you mentioned the FantasyDraftHelp.com Insider and some of the other stuff, the shows with Ken. So there was a familiarity to the idea that we had a group of people who had the potential, if not the existing ability, to do a couple different things. So, you know, to see, say, and we'll use Ken as an example, to see Ken, a born and bred baseball guy, you know, maybe jump in and talk NHL or something, wasn't a huge stretch. We all believe in the abilities of everyone involved. But then you go there. You go to a subject matter that is kind of foreign, at least to the listener base that we had at the time, coming from us. And I think that was that first moment where at least some of us, some more than others, were able to step outside of our comfort zone and embrace something that was very, very important at the time, very worthy of the time slot we gave it, very worthy of the time we devoted to it. And it just sort of was the first stepping out of that comfort zone and saying, look, literally no subject is off limits. We are going to bring this notion of the Great American Radio Show, and it doesn't really matter what the subject is. We're going to give it the same attention we would Super Bowl prep or fantasy draft prep. It's going to be the same product. We're just going to start putting our fingers in different cookie jars.
Exactly. And it's one of those things, too, where in a weird kind of a way, like I know that you as a comic book guy will really kind of get this, that I've always been somebody who has one of the things I define myself by is my very eclectic interests. So if nothing else, this is a show for me But I've always thought of the show almost as kind of like an alter ego for myself. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it was, you know, I have all these interests. I have these things in different areas, and, you know, even I've had to kind of stretch myself a little bit. We've gotten into some stuff where I haven't known about it as much, and I'll do some prep on it, and, you know, research is one of the things that I've kind of prided myself on, so even if I don't know as much about something going in, I'm pretty sure nobody can tell the difference based on the way that I conduct it. So it's been one of those things where, again, I know you have a lot of wide-ranging interests. Other people do as well. So it's the kind of thing here, too, where we kind of tend to think of, you know, a niche, and I don't want to define the show necessarily as niche, but like we kind of tend to think of it as like people who are into just one thing. Well, there's also those of us out there that are into a lot of different kinds of things, too. I don't know if it's a niche. I'd like to think it's bigger than that. But we don't kind of tend to think of serving those people, Jason. We kind of tend to think that that's a scary kind of a thing, and you might frighten somebody off. But I guess from day one, we've always just had the confidence that, like, hey, even if this segment doesn't grab you, the next one will.
Well, and, you know, the funny thing is everybody has more than one facet. And one of the early thoughts that crept into my head that I think helped to move this along was, I'm not a big news guy. I don't watch a lot of news. I find it somewhat depressing. Now, that's not to say I don't find information. I seek out information. But I remember thinking about the news and the millions of people who, from the 1950s on, would gather around the TV or the radio, depending on the situation, and hear a news broadcast, which is very rarely one thing. We've gotten somewhat focused at that time in our history, just sort of in general and how we seek out our entertainment, it sort of felt like you look around and there's 24-hour news, there's 24-hour sports, there's TV channels devoted to cooking and buying houses, and everything had become so specialized that I thought maybe if we just step back a second and say we can do anything, it would really appeal. And then secondarily, each person's a little bit different, and I think we all, in our own little way, kind of treat this as like, let's say, the sports category on Jeopardy. If we're watching Jeopardy here at home, and there's a category like Super Bowls or NBA teams or something, I'll look at my wife and go, oh, it's on, right? And it was sort of that way, because I remember the first time that we had sort of a rundown meeting, and you had suggested a story, and this was in the first two or three, where you had suggested the first topic that was of a geopolitical nature, and everyone in the room knew in a subtle sort of no big deal kind of way, Rick's going to get amped up for this one, because this is a subject matter that outside of your sort of sports talk realm was something that you were very informed on, very well versed on. And it was the beginning of this idea that, hey, we can do these stories because we have somebody somewhere in the FDH ranks that's going to be well versed on this particular topic. And it was the beginning of almost a snowballing effect. Now, I forget what exactly the story was, but I remember it went well. And I remember it was, you know, the Rick Morris first opportunity to go geopolitical. And then from there, you know, we had all kinds of these little smaller, what would seem niche, but we brought the right people into the fold. And especially some of the political stuff. I don't want to say I put it up against anything, but I put it up against a lot because we had people that was something that they did. That was something they possessed. And then, you know, we get into some of these comic book type stuff. Conversation, there was always something that was way outside what most people were doing in the form of discussion entertainment. And it really felt like that moment in the beginning of the movie you're watching where you go, oh, I see what's happening. I can feel it building. And that was the first moment was we thought, yeah, we can do this. It doesn't have to be a mainstream item. We don't need something to hold us to convention. We can step outside the lines, and it is the same
thing. It's the same success. It's the same feel. It's the same show. But we don't have to pigeonhole people. And it was a wonderful, eye-opening moment.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think in my head as you're saying that. You might be alluding to when we had Bill Raggio on the second show for the Iraq War segment that we did, or it might have been week one. We actually did a this was a straw poll because it was a year early for the presidential election, but we did our first presidential election coverage on that show. What's funny is, separate from that, one of the things I remember about the first show is we did a segment, Underrated Hotties, and you know, I went cliche with a capital C with the whole Maura Tierney thing. I'm almost embarrassed looking back on it now because I think she probably makes everybody's list. But there was a name that was put out there by Chris Galloway, and as much of a political wonk as I am, I had not heard of this person. The newly elected governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, whereupon we all did a Google image search like, oh, yeah, okay. So probably the first place that a lot of people heard about Sarah Palin was on our show week one in a decidedly non-political context, Jason.
And, you know, that's the beauty of all this is I don't actually remember that. And in my own mind, I'm sure I can absolutely see myself doing a Google image search and absolutely confirming, yeah, okay. And then, completely separate from that, time passes, and then it's like, oh, hey, here's this political maverick, in big air quotes, and I probably didn't even connect the two.
Yeah.
That's how these things go, but I think that if we wanted to, we could probably do a little mini-segment, and I'm not suggesting that we do it, because we might lose some people, but we could do a small segment just on those topics that are of the, shall we say, celebrity watcher variety.
Mm-hmm.
There's a series of fantasy drafts that we did involving, you know, some people in their respective hotness. Hey, if we're going to say nothing's off topic, nothing can be off topic. And whether that was the way we should have introduced Sarah Palin to the world or not, it was. And then, you know, it just fed into the next thing, which fed into the next thing.
In terms of the overall, the marketing of the show and decisions that are made sometimes for realpolitik, this is something that we haven't done on the show in many, many, many years. But what you just alluded to there, not long after the show got underway, and again, my memory – I'm almost like Rain Man on certain things, and obviously I'm very passionate about this show, so I remember everything about this show. I was at a Super Bowl party, the one that I go to every year that my friend hosts. I was getting some texts from you. You and Sam were going out to Pennsylvania, I believe, to watch the Super Bowl there, and you had been talking with her in the car about the idea of, you know, like a hotness draft, basically. What became the I'd hit that draft, where we were drafting squads of female celebrities. We were rating the hotness of the other ones. And again, memories that I have, the first one that we did, there was a draft pick made of Halle Berry, whereupon one of the listeners emails in, well, you know, she's got six toes, and sends a Google image search in there of her in sandals walking down the street. So whereupon from there, a debate ensues about does Halle Berry's sixth toe gross you out sufficiently that you wouldn't like the rest of her. So we haven't done anything like this in quite some time, Jason, but you talk about the unique stuff that we've done with the show. That seed of an idea that you and Samantha had really bloomed into something.
Yeah, it's the entire time you're kind of thinking, there's no way we get away with this. There's no way it happens. And, you know, and then it becomes a thing, well, we're still, you know, professionals. So, you know, if we treat it like we would anything else, it shouldn't be a problem. And, you know, there were a couple of people that thought, I don't know if I would have done that. But by and large, it was well received. I believe there was any round table, whether it be sports or politics or anything of that nature, it took on the same thing. It was people saying, I see what you're saying, but let me throw this in here as a means to disqualify your pick. It was really no different than doing, you know, a fantasy football draft. We applied the same rules to it, and that was sort of
a thing that carried on for a long time, was that we could take anything and apply it to the same sort of cookie cutter fashion that you would find any story on any network or station across the country. It's just that we're going to do it differently. We're going to cover more things. We're going to do it better.
And I'll tell you this, it's one of these things where looking back on it and names that you would hear again in a different context in the news in years to come. I remember my draft pick from the first one of Ivanka Trump being voted low by one of the judges, allegedly for having no back porch. So there was that. So particularly when we're getting into the finer points of this kind of stuff, again, never say never as far as bringing it back. But it's one of these things where, and again, I will credit Steve Cervillo with this, the ability to bring in some of the great guests that we've had over a period of time, which we certainly aspire to do at the outset, but you never know. That's the thing you can never plan on, is being able to do that. So with the subsequent multiple visits from Bob Barker, from Steve Perry, from Tommy Lasorda, the visits that we had from them, a whole host of other great guests, five times from Kenny Albert. So if putting some of the stuff that's a little more controversial to the side helped pave the way for some of that, which it may have, then it was probably a good trade-off. And like I said, never say never on bringing that back, because it was a lot of fun and it was something we really enjoyed doing. But in terms of looking at the history of the show and how we got from where we were then to where we are now, there's a couple different things here, and they haven't really been properly addressed over the course of the show, not least of which, I won't say properly addressed, because sometimes you just got to wait for the dust to settle a little bit. But when I alluded to the original composition of the group, myself, Chris Galloway, Burrell Jackson, all good friends from Ohio University from those years and the years subsequently, everybody involved in the group had at least some degree of broadcast experience, sometimes very distant, but all were very talented at doing that. Tim Faust, again, had been on Ken Detweiler's show with me as a sidekick a decent amount. Also did a little bit of broadcasting back in college. College roommate of Nate Noy, our good friend that we did a ton of stuff with at the station as well. So everybody knew me. Some of the people knew each other. Outside of Nate, really nobody knew you at the outset. But, you know, we all formed chemistry pretty quickly, and we got through this. And I alluded to this. I was listening to the fourth anniversary retrospective that I did, because when I did that, I thanked all the dignitaries. I thanked the ones that were the original dignitaries that were still with us. And then I think I thought better of it a week later, and I included Burrell in the mix. And this is probably not anything that anybody hasn't already pieced together. So I'm going to get very, very euphemistic here on a couple things, trying to be classy. I'm not a classy person personally, but I try to be professionally. So we could make this a drinking game every time I use a euphemism here. But long story short, he and I, before the show had even started, we had a pretty vicious fight. It was a mutual friend of ours who always thinks this story is entertaining. A scream down at Las Vegas' McCarran International Airport, Jason, if you can imagine that. If you can just imagine me and him bellowing at each other at the top of our lungs, creating a scene there. But that was something that, you know, we should have recorded that, huh? I mean, aside from the fact of how personal it was and the awful things that we said to each other, it would have been very entertaining. But, you know, I thought all that had been put behind us. Early 2009, we subsequently have a kind of similar kind of fight out of nowhere. And in both instances, it was sort of 0 to 600 in 2 seconds. And it's one of those kind of things where, you know, in both cases, it was him initially getting mad at me and there not being any benefit of the doubt of like, well, Rick's my friend. You know, surely he didn't mean this or that or whatever. It just kind of went, you know, nuclear. Like right there. So the second time it happened, it was just kind of like, okay, there's really not any mutual respect between us anymore if this is what the case is. And at that time, it was still live microphones, right? It was a thing where we were doing the show live at the Sports Talk Network. So just kind of had to let it go at that. But unreservedly, again, I thank him as I do all the original dignitaries. He was a great presence on the show. I mean, we have a better lineup today than we did then, but only because we have like 3 or 4 times the number of contributors. It was not addition by subtraction. If he and I could make it work personally, if there was any mutual respect there, he'd be a welcome addition back. But, you know, certain things I just think are unbridgeable. We've all had that happen in life with people. So again, haven't really addressed it in full, but that's where it is. And again, thank him very, very much for everything he brought to the show. Then you get to the station itself. And I guess the overall catch word for the station would be economics here with the Sports Talk Network. I've always said that the Camelot days of that place were 2005 to 2007. All the great people, great friends we had, great talent. Well, we started the show in early 2007. So it was once it was already on the path to what it is now, which if you enter sportstalknetwork.com in your web browser is not an operative website. So it was already starting along that path. Later 2007, you're going to have actually your 10-year anniversary this year, Jason. You and Samantha end up getting married. You moved to Colorado. You'd been at the station for 2+ years, quote unquote, full time, but the station being what it was, you know, again, euphemistically, a married man has to do what a married man has to do. And so you went out to Colorado in search of actual fortunes as opposed to promised fortunes. So, you know, you get out there and that really kind of changed the dynamic a lot because you and I had been the co-executive producers at that point, hands-on. Two of us, you know, side by side on everything, and that sort of pushed me more into the front seat, which, you know, I have taken and I have accepted and certainly I think made the best of in the time there. But that was kind of a jolt. The original crew was already breaking up as far as an every week basis because if you remember, Jason, gas was kind of expensive in 2007. And we didn't have a budget from the station for the show. More about that in a second. So I couldn't ask everybody to keep coming in every week without there being an actual budget established. And again, along the lines of budget, you get to 2010, 2011, and something I've never overtly said before, but at that point we were a brokered show because the station, again, for reasons that I'm not going to get into because, again, I'm trying to take the high road here, but an inability to sell the programming that was there, it was deemed that all the shows need to sell themselves. Well, I think I'm a pretty great marketing guy. I'm a pretty crappy sales guy. We didn't have anybody internally with sales. I've never heard of a deal at a station where the entire place is brokered and where everybody has to sell themselves, but that's what it basically turned into. So we had a little bit of cash that was piled up with STN, a little bit of work that had been done outside the broadcast purview. We basically paid the production costs for a while, and you know, when the money ran out, we moved the show. And episode 152, I like to call that going out the Ted Williams way with a home run in the last at bat. Dan Weldon coming off the Indy 500, Road Warrior Animal, and Gaylord Perry. So, you know, that was basically the transition to what it was there. And then Russ Cohen finds a home for us with Sportsology, helping us to produce this show in the form of podcasts. And at first when we left there, it was like, okay, we're doing podcasts now. We'll move back to some other broadcast entity at a certain point. But in the last 5 years, the whole world has moved to on-demand. So we're probably at this point always going to be on-demand, even if that wasn't the initial thing there. We'd like it to be bigger and better, obviously, in a lot of ways. But that basically kind of covers how that went. So any thoughts that you have about that entire rambling screed that I had about some of the changes from then to the present day, Jason, take it away.
Well, yeah, you know, life happens first off, and even if we sort of step back just from the lounge aspect of things, that 2005 to 2007 stretch basically feels like the early stages of any biopic movie.
Yep.
That was the, you talk about Steve Jobs or something. This was the part where, you know, we weren't established necessarily. We didn't have a problem walking down the streets of our town, but everyone could recognize that there was talent there. There was a lot of good going on in that building, and I think in some strange way, we kind of hoped that this genesis of this thing called the FDH Lounge, we would be able to use some of those people, and we did over time. And then there was, I don't want to call it political, but there were some circumstances that prevented some from saying, look, as long as you're in that building and you're doing things with certain people, I'm just not going to be a part of it. And we respected that. We let people pick and choose what they wanted to do. And then, you know, like I said, life happens, and We had some concerns, which forced at least two of us to move. it was what it was, and we rolled with the punches as best we could. I do want to mention, though, and I think everyone that might be listening has been in a situation like this. In the corporate world, you kind of see it a little bit more bureaucracy and red tape and all of this. And when it happens, everyone has the same reaction. But as I would have imagined, when every show in the building went brokered, it was almost like being a toddler and having your parent walk up to you and go, "Hey, we're going to have broccoli. I'm not going to be excited about this proposition." And I can't imagine that anyone would have been. And I always, from the beginning, understanding how broadcast entertainment works and radio specifically, I understood how things go. But even I had to step back and go, no, that's not exactly right. You don't take the people that are essentially creating this great thing and tell them that now you have to take on this other responsibility of a skill set most of you don't have. And if you're not able to cut it, then, there won't be a show. And that, I think, started the whole process of you, even more so than most, as sort of the head of the totem pole, whether you want to acknowledge that or not. Of finding yourselves in situations that were not ideal and basically having a handful of people making huge sacrifices for the betterment of the product. And then eventually it just came to a point where we had to collectively, and I use that term loosely because I think ultimately we all would have said what you would have wanted, no matter what that was at this point, knowing what you had been through to that point. A decision was made, and if that means that we had to turn our back on terrestrial or studio work, as it were, and sort of change this thing up, fine. Because as it turns out, as you mentioned, the whole world kind of started to go towards that new media meets on demand meets convenience of circumstance, and I think ultimately we were okay with it. Luckily, we're able to keep moving and keep on doing the same thing, just in a different scenario. And I think everyone's been okay with that.
I think so. And again, and I appreciate the points that you made there. And again, it's a thing where I think all of us would acknowledge, just out of fairness, because like I said, I'm not trying to use this to bury anybody, but just to clarify what we've been through in a way that we've never really done before. Because you'll notice that names are not coming out of my mouth, individual names, as far as MFing anybody or like that. I think we would all admit, out of fairness, new media, particularly in the 2000s, the broadcast thing here, very tough to monetize. So I think guys like me and you probably look at this and say, some of this was going to be inherent to any operation, and this is where I get euphemistic again. Some of it was inherent to that operation. Choices that were made, things that were done, things that were not done. I think it was kind of a stew that kind of brought it to that point. And again, the slide from the glory days of 05 to 07, at least critically, on a critical level at that station, to where it is now. And again, the URL, as I referenced before, if you enter that into your browser, what you get now. And it was a continuum that we were on. And I had some dark days trying to hold it together in 2010 and in 2011. I will be very quick to stipulate that what I'm about to say, I am not admitting to any illegalities. I did not commit any illegalities, but there are things I had to do to keep the show in the good graces of the place, even above and beyond kicking the money back. There are things that I had to do as far as making phone calls to individuals, asking things of people, et cetera, that I am not proud of. I went against my own moral code, quite frankly, keeping that show there as long as I did. Ways that I compromised myself that I'm not proud of, but like I said, nothing illegal, but just morally I can't justify everything. But that's how much I care about the show. And I don't think I need to underline that to anybody, but how badly I wanted to keep it there. And again, who knew what the future was going to hold? But, you know, a couple months after we get out of there, before you know it, boom, Bob Barker's back on the show. Ken Shamrock's coming on to celebrate the 500th hour of the program with us. Boom, boom, boom. Onward and upward. The guest lineup and the bookings that Steve Cervillo has been very central in making over the years, the relationships that we've had, we've been able to augment the show in that kind of a way. And again, while it's become, as you alluded to, sort of, it's still an ensemble. I'll always define it that way, but it's now more, you know, me with one of you guys in a rare happy occasion, sometimes more than one. Like, I miss those days. I miss those early days. Logistically, it's hard to do. Even when I can piece it together where a couple of us can do stuff over the phone, it's not quite the same as sitting there doing it. It'll never be the same as that, but that's okay. We have those shows. We have everything that we went through in those early days. We have the memories of it, and I continue to get stuff archived and posted online, and I will always continue to do so until every last minute that I've got of the show, which is probably like 99% of it, that I have saved on various devices until I can get it cut up and put up there. That's my goal, you know, in the decades, hopefully before I die, is to finish that process. But again, for a show that covered anything and everything over the period of time, you know, we've had obviously some very big stories over the course of time. I did a ranking recently here as part of our retrospective. I deemed the number one news story of the last decade to be the Great Recession and everything that came out of it, because I think in many ways that's been a shadow that's hung over the better part of the last 10 years, is this very, very slow recovery from this very, very low point that we were at. You know, in the sports world, the continuing almost unprecedented greatness of Tom Brady at the level he's been at with the Patriots, which pains me to say because I'm not a Brady or a Belichick guy, but you've had that. You and I have lived five different lifetimes alone with LeBron James and the Cavaliers. The last couple of sad years in Cleveland of just reaching and scratching in vain. He leaves, he goes to Miami, he comes back, they win a championship in 2 years. I mean, in any number of ways in the last decade in the world, there have been so many different things happening here. You know, I would just like to get your account of some of the big ones, some of the big lasting things that you've been thinking about that I know we've been talking about on the show in the last 10 years.
Well, the funny thing is, you mentioned LeBron, and I don't presume to tell anyone who's a fan of that city, that team, or even the player, how they are supposed to think about these things. But getting me through the process, because let's be honest, if we're talking about sports, even if we're talking about pro wrestling on some level, which, you know, sort of crosses over in this Venn diagram of discussion, is that people have their favorites. They have the ones that really stick out. And for me, and maybe it's just how you're raised, but I knew before I knew what sports really was, I knew what teams I liked, and I knew why I was supposed to like them. And that's because that's what my mother liked, and my grandfather, and my uncles, and so on. But that's, if anyone's ever seen that Believeland documentary thing that was all over Netflix for a while, there's a part in there where I think it's Tony Grossi mentions that being a Cleveland sports fan is not something one just decides to do. You don't just wake up in your 20s and go, I'm going to be a Cleveland fan. You're either born into it or you're not. And if you're not, then it's fine. Go enjoy yourself elsewhere. But for me, this all follows a nice timeline because I had season tickets to see LeBron in his rookie year. And a couple years later, you know, I'm doing shows with you talking about the NBA or how it affects fantasy and then doing some insider stuff as a sort of station NBA guy for a while. And then when the move happened, and I mean me, not him, you know, everything was fine, but I was in a different place. I was in a new place where – let's be honest, at the time, people were more interested in Allen Iverson's resurgence as a Denver Nugget than they were what's going on in Cleveland, because it had become status quo. It was, they're going to win 50, 60 games, and then something's going to fall apart in the playoffs, and we'll look on to next year. And as a Cleveland fan, you're content with that. We'd been bad for so long in so many capacities that we were okay being a 60-win
you know, lose in the Eastern Conference Finals kind of team. But eventually that wasn't going to hold up. And I remember I was, and again, I won't get into specifics because they're not sponsoring the show, but I was working for something that was not sports media related.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going into a break room and standing there in front of a large 50-some-inch flat screen TV with a whole bunch of other people that were hooping and hollering and getting loud. And it was like people were taking bets as to where he was going to go. And I remember thinking, he's not going anywhere. What are you crazy? That's not going to happen. This is going to be the moment when he puts this city up on his shoulders. And I had this great optimistic approach to it. And I remember watching the decision, and I remember the earth shaking under me as people were, again, hooting and hollering. And I remember what that felt like. And again, I still go back to the FDH Lounge, some of the fantasy stuff we had done, some of the stuff that we had had conversations. And no one outside of the circle will understand this, but studio, control room, lobby. And there was something beautiful about someone in the control room taking the show to break, either because it was about to get out of hand or because it was just time, following a segment where someone said something that was going to draw the ire of everybody else. So they go to break. Everyone falls out of the air studio. Producer walks out into the lobby and goes, "What the heck?" And all of a sudden, you've got a whole other show going on outside the lobby. And it was these great memories of really seeing the evolution of LeBron and all this. And I remember, as bad as it felt, I could at least hold on to those collective memories of what it was like when we had 12 people in the same, you know, 25 square feet, just jawing at each other about whatever it was. It could be something as simple as converting back to a 4-3 defense or something. But people were so very passionate about it, so very talented. So the whole LeBron leaving Cleveland to Miami thing, actually, it's deeper than that for me. I have tons of memories that come back to this. And then one of the big things was when it came back and you know, winning and everything. I don't know about you, but I didn't watch basketball for those 4 years. I really didn't. And it was so literally tied to this ex-girlfriend mentality that I'm afraid to watch the Milwaukee Bucks play the San Antonio Spurs for fear that they might show me a highlight of LeBron in black and red, and I wouldn't be able to handle that. But when it all came back, everything comes back to the thought of what it would have been like if we could supplant ourselves and say, you know, 2014 back into the 2006, 2007 versions of ourselves and really be able to experience that the way we wish we could have. But to do it separately
is rough. Exactly. That is one of the defining stories we covered. You and I did some very cathartic post-LeBron leaving shows here. It kind of broke down what happened over the course of the last 7 years. And again, like you said, who could imagine what lay in front of us here? But to cover all these stories in the way that we have, talk to all the, you know, not dozens, I would say hundreds of people that we've talked to over the course of the show. Again, that all came out of the initial meetings and the template that you and I came up with back in the day. You and I together as the co-creators coming up with this vision. So, again, you over the course of time, even been a better friend to me than a colleague, and I really appreciate it. Again, onward and upward for both of us here. Look forward to seeing what we're going to do subsequently. And thank you for everything, Jason.
No problem. It always comes back to the lounge.
It always does. Thank you for joining us, everybody, on the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.